This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast, and here I am with my co-host, Jon, and a special guest.
See how happy Dave is when he just doesn't have to compete just with me, but has two people he can compete with. He's just so good. He wants more than one opposition.
Yeah, let's go with that. No, it's always fun when we have a guest to come and join us, and it's someone with a little bit of a different background to some of the folks we've had on most recently. So we're going to be chatting with Paranda, who comes from and is the current founder and CEO of Sotero. And he's had an interesting career journey, I think, but probably best to let him tell us about it himself, unless there's anything else from you, Jon.
Nope, sounds like a plan.
Let's do it. So today we are joined by a special guest, Paranda. Welcome to the Roaring Elephant Podcast.
Thank you. My pleasure being here.
So you reached out to us, and you have what I would call quite an interesting background. You've had an interesting kind of career journey with a few kind of twists and turns along the way. Currently CEO and founder of Sotero.
Yes. Certainly an interesting background. I've gone from exploiting data to helping companies protecting data. I am now the CEO and co-founder of Sotero. We are a Boston-based company in the cybersecurity space, but more specifically in the data security and protection space.
Fantastic. So when you say kind of data protection, you know, what does that mean in this particular context? Yeah, whose data were you protecting and sort of how are you protecting it?
Great question. I mean, these are confusing times and scary times, both from a security need perspective and the challenges that companies face in terms of data protection. What we focus on is essentially, like I said, data protection, and that is essentially a really broad topic, right? Data is collected by pretty much every organization in the world, which is pretty apparent because the current economy is driven predominantly by data and the user data. But when you think about how it's stored and collected, it ranges anywhere from a small minute database to being on your laptop to being in these petabyte-sized databases or even files. And then you look at the applications that interact with those data, it's like probably a million different applications, if not more. That makes it incredibly challenging for organizations to figure out how to achieve optimal and uniform data protection, right? What you do for a database is not the same as what you do for a file. What you do for data in a browser is not the same for what you do in data that's collected in a website. Data protection is one aspect. Then you have all these regulatory requirements that the different governments and organizations are enforcing, because it's such a wild west out there in terms of what companies do and how they protect data. So our goal is to help companies come up with a singular way, an easy singular way to protect data uniformly across all of their data collection platforms, provide that uniformity, the scale, while not limiting the business from accessing and using the data for legitimate and valid purposes. Where you see a lot of risk with data protection is where companies cut corners, because if they do something, that means it's friction and obstruction to the business process, which is good. But on the flip side, that's where the vulnerabilities exist. That's what the attackers exploit and get their access to data. So we're working on providing this umbrella, if you will, that provides a uniform layer of protection while enabling businesses to continue to operate at the scale they need.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, the phrase that initially popped into my head when kind of thinking about the journey that you've taken, because you started off in far more of the the data collection side of the world, was that the phrase that popped in my mind was like poacher turned gamekeeper. You know, you were in the business of collecting all the data, and now you're in the business of protecting all the data. You know, after spending so much time and you know, working with some very successful companies in that kind of data collection and, you know, data use sort of space, like how did you transition into the data security space? Like what did that look like?
So there were actually two events, right? One was being in that space, being the CTO at some of the largest marketing services providers. We built databases for name a brand, and we probably had them as a customer, enabling them to collect their customer information, reach out to them, market to them, analyze them. So there's a lot of sensitive information that we were collecting. The challenges of protecting the data and operating at scale, so that was the underlying current, right? That was always in my mind as to how difficult it was to actually keep data protected. Along with this, I was actually a victim of a data breach, right? My data was stolen and they attempted to monetize it by filing a fraudulent tax return, opening up credit card applications, opened up a bank account, et cetera, et cetera. That event kind of crystallized in my mind that something different had to be done, a different approach, a different mindset, and a different technology capability in terms of helping companies that collected data and operated in data keep the data secure and private so they could live up to their commitments to their customers. Kind of thinking about it and looking at it, I was familiar with all of the products and the technologies that existed for data protection. So that old saying of hire a crook to catch a crook, that was stuck on me.
Nice.
So what do your old customers think about you now?
They're probably happy that I'm actually working on something that enables them to sleep better at night. I mean, at least that's what I tell myself.
You mentioned that, you know, one of the things that really kind of catalyzed you to get involved in this side of the space was like being a victim of a data breach. And obviously this is like one of the challenges is there's so much data online about so many of us. You know, the chances that that these breaches, well, not the chances, but like breaches are happening like more and more frequently, and the breaches, because more companies are holding more data, the breaches themselves are getting larger and larger. You know, we did some, you know, an episode a while back now on kind of the different like sizes and growths of data breaches that were happening, you know, across the space. It seems to be like this is a problem that is only getting worse. Is there a way that organizations can, like, how do organizations mitigate this if they're not, you know, engaging with your organization, your service? Like, how do they normally kind of go about trying to mitigate these kind of situations?
Absolutely. That's a great question. I will point out one thing, right? I mean, you kind of brought up the fact that the data breaches are happening and they're bigger, right? That's one of the challenges in how people perceive what's going on. People tend to look at these data breaches or data losses as episodic events that are siloed. The true story is they're not. The data aggregation, data collection across many breaches and many sources, just like you would imagine analytics and data collation happening on the legitimate side, is also happening on the dark side. That's why the breaches, the scams, the attempts are getting so much more sophisticated in addition to having access to technology. So now when they send out a phishing scam or an email scam, that actually works on collated data, and the attacker is a lot more intelligent about the target. So that makes it even more dangerous and powerful, because now they're pulling at strings that make you actually tend to believe that this is real, because they have so many pieces of information they pull together to assemble the truth. So that being said, organizations, I mean, if you really think about it, the regulatory and the financial impact on companies losing data is very recent. Right. In addition to that, the escalating premiums for cyber insurance is also recent. So prior to this, organizations didn't really have a motive in trying to get ahead of this. They would, I mean, the attitude was, if we lost data, great, we'll tell a couple of people that we lost data. What's the big deal? We're not paying a price for it. Now, with EU being one of the leading things, the GDPR framework being one of the leading teeth, if you will, that bites, the attitude is changing rapidly, because it's not just the financial aspects, there's the legal aspect in terms of lawsuits. There's the escalating cyber insurance premium. So all of that is coming together to force organizations to say, you've got to take a more holistic look at what you're doing, and also own up to the fact that you shortchanged cybersecurity for such a long time. The other side of the coin is, cybersecurity is always believed that in this notion of defense in depth, meaning lock down the periphery, and if they can't get inside, nothing's going to happen. But as we're seeing, locking down the periphery is almost an impossible task, right? And it's validly so, because you have so many interactions, so many integrations, and so many other organizations that you're sharing data with, because that's part of your business model.
Yeah.
So now you kind of fall back on this thing and saying, we have to do everything we need to do the periphery, but you live with the fact, assuming that you are going to get breached somewhere, somehow. And then what do you do? So you build a second layer of defense on what the attackers are after, which is the data or the information. That's where companies like us come in and saying, fine, you think you need at the periphery, that's not enough, as you're seeing in everyday headlines. You need a second layer of defense that sits on what the attackers are coming after, which is the data. So use a product like ours, or use technology like ours to protect yourself or be the backstop, knowing that somebody's going to get into your network.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you mentioned GDPR, and, you know, my guess is that things like GDPR have drastically, like, transformed this space. But I also, apart from the, you mentioned, like, obviously regulations like this having real teeth and real legal impact, like, how has it really changed the mindset of organizations around what this kind of data protection means and the impacts of it?
Absolutely. In many ways, right? I mean, GDPR, and that is evolving. The mindset is still evolving, because GDPR in the initial days didn't have any teeth to it. Or there wasn't much of an enforcement. It was more of a threat. And companies don't react to threats. They actually react to real-time pain. Once that has started to happen, and there's been a lot of pushback, right? And needing to retain data in the EU, not being able to move data, and EU threatening to shut down platforms and businesses if they don't do certain things. I mean, I believe it was Brazil that just shut down one of the major platforms. India has rolled out new regulation. There's countries across the board. There's a multitude of states within the US that are rolling out privacy regulation, because there's not been action at the federal level. So yeah, companies are now saying, this is real and this is serious. We can't continue to operate the way we did. And that is causing a lot of things, not just on the security side, even on the technology and the operations side, where they're building platforms and not moving data back here, and limiting access to specific data sets, limiting ads or monetization of data for specific regions. Yeah, it has caused quite a mind shift.
Interesting. I mean, one of the things would seem to be, there was always brand impact when these kind of situations happened. But it seems to me now that we live in a time where there's a lot more, or I should say a lot less, brand loyalty on the consumer side now. And people, you know, chop and change services almost at a whim. Like, sometimes it's based on price, sometimes it's based on, you know, the brand reputation being taking a hit and things like that. How does that factor in, do you think, in the weighting between, like, the obviously the legislation that we've just talked about, and that having teeth, and that is going to be one thing, but like the market itself shifting to being a lot more agile and a lot more kind of dynamic than it ever has been?
Yeah, good. So that was the original perception, right? That a data loss, a data breach, or an incident like that would cause a massive, would cause brand or reputational damage. Honestly, in my opinion, that impact has been vastly overrated or exaggerated, because the impact on brand loyalty, at least in the US, has been minimal. I mean, if you go back and look at the credit union incident, right? If you go back and look at the airline incident, the hotel incident, the hotel industry incident, most recently the healthcare industry incident, impact on impact on brand loyalty has been very minimal, in my opinion, because consumers are at a point where they don't care. To your point, they're more worried about convenience. They're more worried about ease of use and familiarity, that they're willing to live with the thing. What consumers haven't been able to connect the dots to is the impact that it's having on their personal reputation and damage that it caused, because the data was made available from a specific brand. Because if you think about it, that data is the driver for all those scams and phishing attempts at the personal level. So once those dots are connected, I think, in my opinion, we'll start to see a bigger impact on brands.
Now, is this also something to do with the secrecy behind it? Because it's only recently that in Europe, I know that there's a law that if you have a data breach, you're obligated to make it public within X amount of days that you had lost data and you have to inform the public. Before that law existed, people weren't even aware. If you didn't go to Have I One Pound or something like that, you didn't even know if you were in a hacking database. So if you don't know about it, it's just going to happen. And I'm not entirely sure if in the US it has a similar kind of legislation that data breaches need to be made public or not.
That's a great point, and absolutely right. If consumers or individuals are able to tie back the impact on them to a specific brand, absolutely. The challenge with that in the US is this: three data losses a week. So consumers are getting hit with multiple notifications in the span of a small window of time. So they're like, and at some point, even that begins to kind of stop having an impact on you personally. The first couple are scary. After that, you go like, well, my social security number, for example, is already out there. So they stole it again.
And I mean, I got a personal system to figure out if my data got hacked or not, because whenever I sign up for somewhere on the internet, I create a unique email address. So every connection I have on the internet has a unique email address. If I ever get spam on that address, I know that they've been hacked. And what I've noted is that, sure, I got a mail that data breach happened at company, I have never heard of them, but they were kind of the data owners behind these web front ends. So even connecting the dots on that point, it's very hard if you don't really know how to do this.
I'm sure you folks are aware that the most recent one was where the social security number of pretty much every US citizen was breached and stolen. I mean, think about the impact, and nobody's ever heard of this organization that collected, stored, and provided this information.
Yeah.
None of us have any direct interaction with this company at all, but they pretty much had this, like, everybody's sensitive information across the entire country.
Yeah Wild, some of the things that are kind of coming out of the woodwork. So what are some of the challenges of doing kind of data protection both at this scale and across such a wide variety of different formats and types and kind of end solutions?
And so that's the challenge and the opportunity, right? Historically, security solutions and even data security solutions were all built as point solutions, right? If you had a particular flavor of a database, and you, at whatever point you realized you had sensitive information in there and you needed a product to encrypt it, protect it, you went and bought a product. Then you realize that your company doesn't have just one flavor of a database, you have seven, right? And then you kind of prioritize that and say, out of the seven, these three are critical, let's worry about protecting these. The other four, we don't care because nobody has access to it outside of the company. That's not a valid approach, but that's what people did for from a prioritization and a budget and a time perspective, right? That's the database side of it. Now you look at the unstructured data, the files. You have multiple file servers on-premise. Then you start to adopt the cloud. You have multiple file stores or object stores within the cloud. You're sending your data to multiple third parties. So you have 15, 20 different data storage platforms. When you think about this, you're already looking at 7, 8, 9 different products to protect data, right? And then think about the number of applications that interact with all these data stores. You're now up in the 40, 50 different technology platforms that have to interact with data that's protected. And everything that you do to protect data is perceived as being a barrier or something that slows down your revenue or business, right? And then you think about doing it at the scale that companies collect data today. We're talking about petabytes of data a day. So if you if a product is not performant enough or doesn't work fast enough, you're talking about impacting, introducing meaningful latencies into the business process. So when you pull all of this together, you're looking at a fairly large challenge of providing a platform that operates at near real time without impacting business, covers multiple application technologies, covers multiple storage platforms, and doesn't require years and years of implementation and integration to achieve this framework, right? That's just the technology framework. Then you think about what the product has to do. It has to protect data. It has to enable valid or credentialed users to access and use data at real time or at business speed, as you would say. You need to provide logging. You need to provide audit trails. You need to protect it against multiple threats, including insider threats, ransomware attacks, malware attacks, data exfiltration attempts. Right. You also need to facilitate recovery, backup, restoration, et cetera, without impact anything. You need to integrate key management, right? And have the ability to potentially rotate keys in regulated industries. This is the kind of a platform or a product that you're looking at. And then when you look at it from that perspective, that kind of gives you an idea of the challenges of building a platform that operates at the scale and provides the complexity of services that you need.
Yeah.
To be honest, it sounds impossible because I used to work for a company that did data governance, and just figuring out how many data sources there were and what the names were was already an impossibility to do.
I'll give you an example that we recently ran into a regulated industry that has sensitive data in files that they want to protect. The amount of data is relatively small, probably a couple of terabytes, but the complete deployment is probably about 40 terabytes. So the cost of protecting 2 against 40 is different. It's significant. They're tempted to go with the 2 terabyte solution, but they've got probably a couple of hundred different processes that are operating on it, about 1,500 users that interact with the data, and the amount of time that it would actually take them to isolate the data into this 2 terabyte storage, they're estimating that to be 3 years. So the solution is spend the money on the 40 terabytes. You'll be up running faster. The solution will be effective as opposed to waiting 3 years to kind of save a little bit of money.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the first part of our talk with Purandar. Kind of fun stuff. I mean, this is, as you mentioned at the beginning, totally different kind of guest that we've had before. I mean, I remember the email he sent to ask us if we'd have him on the show was kind of... okay, why not? And I think it turned out quite well.
Yeah. Interesting background, interesting journey. We have more of Purandar to come.
Yep, next episode is going to be more on the technical side. But we'll just leave that until next week. So unless you have anything else to add.
Nothing else from me.
Then that is all the time we have for today. You can become a Patreon, support our podcast, contributions help us keep this in the air and get good guests like this. We are also on YouTube, where you can see us and not just hear us, which might be good or bad, depending on your preferences. But you can also hit subscribe buttons, notification bells, so everybody can find something to do there. And if that doesn't work for you, you can go to our website at www.roaringelf.org. There's links there to all the other stuff. And you can also still send email, plain old email, to podcast@roaringelf.org with your suggestions, feedback, and anything else you want to share with us. Until next time, my name is Anonymous John.
And my name is Interesting Career Dave.
I look forward to talking to you again next week. Goodbye.
See you then.